Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, live from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. Each week on air on The Farm Report, we talk about the ins and outs of the food system. Off air, I'm the executive director for the Heritage Radio Network. And I'm excited to say we have a jam-packed show for you today. We're continuing our conversation exploring the meat industry. Getting prepped up for the Slow Meat Conference, which is happening the first weekend in June, hosted by our friends at Slow Food USA. We're going to start the show off today with Gabriel Krenza. He is the Strategic Advisor of Food Procurement for the National Resource Defense Council. Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Erin. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So for folks who aren't familiar with the NRDC story, you know, your organization started in 1970 with kind of a mission to protect our land, air, and water. Started actually, I think, the same year that Earth Day was created. And now you guys are, I was surprised. I didn't realize you were quite so big, employing nearly 500 scientists, lawyers, and policy experts. And millions of members and online activists. For folks who maybe aren't as familiar with the scope of your work, can you talk a little bit about the role that you play within the organization and how NRDC got involved with the kind of food conversation?
Of course. And it's a bit of a long story, so feel free to jump in wherever. but I'll start with... So the Natural Resources Defense Council, as you said, has been around for quite some time now. And while it began largely as a litigating NGO, going on to Capitol Hill and really working to effect change for the environment, through the government, so to speak, we have since really expanded our programs. And ways in which we can affect change through many different outlets. And starting about 10 years ago, there's a gentleman by the name of Alan Hershkowitz who is a senior resource conservationist at NRDC, started working with looking at ways in which you can quote unquote green large events and the impacts that massive events, whether they be entertainment or sports or large galas, the Grammys, the Academy Awards, etc., just the impacts that those had and also the potential to really communicate best environmental practices to the audiences. And we actually started with the Oscars about 10 years ago, and then very quickly as momentum gained, moving into the sports world, the professional sports world, and NRDC started to engage the National Football League, the National Hockey League, basketball, and Major League Baseball in small efforts that could have big impacts. Small environmental efforts that could have big impacts and then also really communicate to fans. And the last 10 years, it's really been focused around energy use, waste, and water, so waste diversion and water. And we started the Green Sports Alliance, which has since now moved, and it's its own operating nonprofit. There's 300 teams around the world that work with the Green Sports Alliance and make these kind of commitments towards best practices, and I can go into them, but I share that story now because just about 2 years ago, the conversation of food at sporting events really started to become a topic of interest to many folks, just given the quantities and then also access to largely a population that we could really share a strong message with, and one in which I think everyone can connect. And I was brought on to work specifically in food strategy. So I actually hold two titles. I'm the senior advisor for food procurement with the Green Sports Alliance, mm-hmm. and then also with NRDC. I work with NRDC in their food procurement area, and within NRDC, I'll share. I actually work, and there's lots of different acronyms, and they get all sorts of confusing, but I work for a very fun, small, dynamic team within NRDC called the Center for Market Innovation. And that was started, I want to say, maybe about 12 years ago by folks that largely hold MBAs. And it's looking at large business solutions that also can, you know, have a triple bottom line impact, but I would say the big bottom line we're looking at is the green one, and so a lot of focus on impact investing and really the energy market, and most recently again, and I think it's just wonderful timing is food, and how do we affect change within a highly industrialized system for food production. And where are the big kind of elephants, so to speak, or the big bulls in the room? And that's, I believe, in meat production. So we, within the sporting world, and there's a lot of parallel. I mean, it might sound like big teams, but there's a lot of communication back and forth. And the Green Sports Alliance is a wonderful avenue to get this message out, and the Center for Market Innovation works hand in hand, really, kind of from the industry side all the way up to consumer, to really find little leverage points that can bring about quite a bit of change. So I hope that was a bit of a thorough overview for you.
Yeah, definitely getting us oriented. I have to say, and maybe this is because I'm a person who has always had kind of food at the forefront of my brain, but I'm kind of consistently surprised in what I feel is kind of a late adaptation of looking at food and food production and food consumption and food waste by the environmental community. Because it seems like producing, you know, it's also like just kind of one of those basic human needs, and yet I feel like it's a newer component to groups like the NRDC who are doing this type of environmental work, and the same goes for kind of animal welfare organizations, which tend to have, I feel like, a focus on wild animals or animals that we've domesticated for pets, and kind of largely leaves out this whole swath of livestock, which is something so many of us really engage with kind of intimately on a daily, if not like multiple times a day basis. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit from where you sit as to, does it seem like a late adaptation to you too, or do I just not know the history well enough?
So I would say we have largely worked on, if we want specifically livestock issues, it's been a key focus of ours. And what's fascinating about the livestock industry is it really does transcend so many different issues, whether it be land use, water quality, climate, also governments subsidizing and where different resources from the government go to support agriculture. So for NRDC, it really is a topic that encompasses many, many different projects of ours.
Mm-hmm.
I would not say by any means we are late to the game in working on these issues, but because it has been very much an organization for many years that works in the litigation world, that much of that work was not I guess the flagpole of our messaging, so to speak. And we worked a lot with the Farm Bill, the latest iteration, and previous workings before that. This work specifically with I should also share that we're actively engaged right now. NRDC is in working to support and define a comprehensive definition of what better beef production can look like in the United States, and a collaborative and comprehensive standard that is looking to cast the net as wide as we can. I think it would be a disservice to say we're looking to define what sustainable beef is, because I don't think that may not be definable, or that may not just be the right appropriation of words to the topic, but better beef production for sure, and certainly there's some key measuring points. I think, again, this is something that NRDC and kind of our many different fingers, we have five national offices, that it has been a topic of long concern. We have had an ongoing antibiotics campaign in the poultry industry for almost 5 years now, and we're starting to see, there's many folks working on that, but you're starting to see that conversation elevated quite a lot with businesses taking on commitments, which is really great to see.
Yeah, definitely, like, lots of action from the NRDC. And I didn't mean to imply that, you guys aren't kind of in a robust way pursuing work in the food space. It does always just, like, seem interesting, like, how much the food conversation has expanded and how many kind of, like, tendrils and rabbit holes and paths it takes you down. I'm curious, you had said earlier one of the tenets of your work is really identifying kind of the big players or the elephants in the room or the leverage points for affecting kind of large-scale change. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on the Walmart and Sam's Club USA recent announcement with regards to humane treatment of farm animals and responsible use of antibiotics in farm animals. I mean, of course, they are a huge player in that space.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think there are some really key areas we focus on to really see if we can affect small actions that might affect big change or even big actions. But again, yes, I would say the major buyers within that very confusing, often intertwining supply chain of livestock, specifically beef, but poultry and pork as well, the large buyers really have quite a bit of power to shift shift production from the ground up, and yes, we have done quite a bit of outreach and continue to do so to work with large buyers to support them, so kind of advise and work with has been a big I have been witness to there being a fair amount of effort to really work with organizations to develop strategies for them, and that's kind of where some of the cost analysis of kind of business plans come into play, and really looking into the numbers of, well, if you were to buy antibiotic-free chicken, is the supply out there, and could we really figure out a way for it to be, cost impact. And that's you know, there's two forces at play. There's, you know, what and many of us in the environmental world share, which is really kind of a deep feeling of wanting to do what's going to fix some of these problems at all costs, and then also working within the scope of how do we really frame this in a way where it makes sense and it works for these businesses to, you know, remain at least competitive, right?
Sure.
To remain businesses and also take on better and better. So it's a...
To me, you know, you're taking a tactic instead of, you know, kind of in one extreme version, standing outside of a corporate office and protesting with signs, to kind of gaining entree to these kind of internal decision-making spaces and making yourself as an organization a resource and like approachable for a group like that. I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a little point of view as if we were a fly on the wall in some of these initial conversations. If there's a large food buyer that you are setting up some initial meetings with, what are some of the jumping off points for them? What is, do you think, kind of prompting them reaching out to you or the NRDC to say, like, hey, can you help us think through or strategize? I mean, do they come to you? Do you go to them? And what are those starting points kind of look like?
Well, I would say, it's a good question. I would say that the conversation can start either way. I actively do a fair amount of outreach, but it, again, our work is, completely donation-based, funded, much like I'm sure yours is, but
yeah.
our advising is all pro bono. So that alone, is very helpful in getting a conversation going, because we're not in for it for anything other than, you know, kind of environmental wins. And we have framed the offer as an environmental and a business win, and that there's really looking to understand their industry. So again, like, beef right now is at an all-time high, and is it going to be attractive for them if we are finding better beef that demands an even higher premium? Well, that is a challenge right now. And do I think that better beef should demand a premium? Yeah, probably should. It's produced in a much more kind of holistic way. But with that said, we've also looked to. So the one big number that always stands out to me, and I think in the slow food movement, it's one that it's a hard one, but kind of 97% of all the beef produced in our country is grain finished, you know, comes from corn. And our supply of pasture finished beef is relatively small. And how can we, so there's big businesses that just by default, and they might be able to source and serve, some meals in certain areas. I'm thinking of like a big sports stadium. And
right.
They're a great example, because I think it's almost like a microcosm of what maybe a large restaurant chain might look like, where the menu has different options and they are coming at different price points. But within a stadium, right, there's going to be the option of some nice grass-fed burger. It may come at a bigger expense. It may not. It may just be harder to find. But oftentimes these kind of operations directors or these head chefs, really, I have to empathize with them in some way, because there is, there's kind of that push-pull of price, and then there's the push-pull of quantity. And finally, there's a lot of confusion around what is better, and what are small steps that can be taken. And right now, I think there's a lot of, this is an obvious statement, but there's a tremendous amount of room for improvement in livestock feeding, and specifically in their finishing phase in the feedlots. And you know, it's heartbreaking that the system has, I would say, industrialized to that point, but there's still, I think, demonizing it without having any strong solutions is kind of a disservice to the whole movement. So are there, you know, are there really specific areas within the feedlot industry that you can begin to look into the nuances of the practices and say, this is better, this is not, this is harmful, this is less harmful?
Yeah, kind of flipping that around. And I think what's interesting to me about working, looking specifically at the beef industry, is that on some level, because of their size and their biology, that you know, steers, you can't abuse. And I think that word is the right word. You can't abuse in the same way that you can, you know, poultry or other smaller livestock. I feel like in a lot of ways we haven't figured out that I guess beef already has like a leg up on other livestock and poultry because of its size. It really confines the level of confinement and the growing protocols. You know, you're never going to see, you know, kind of a vertical, you know, beef farm and the crowding and the caging in the same way you would see in poultry. So it does feel like a space that's ripe to, you know, find some spaces to open up. I'm wondering if you're, you know, kind of looking away from the people purchasing and looking back towards the farmers who are producing, is there a level of kind of eagerness or desire for your services? And if so, by whom? Are you getting these from, you know, feedlot operators who are like, hey, we want to figure out a different way? Or are you getting kind of asks and pushes from folks who are on the grass-based system already and looking for an enhanced kind of like marketplace or more support or more guidelines that undergird the type of production they're already employing?
Another great question and a big one, but I will start with simple answer of both. I mean, I managed a cattle ranch for 4 years in Northwest Montana. And it was a third-generation ranch that started as a cow-calf operation, whereas you auction your calves at 2 years, basically two feedlots, and then you have no idea where they go, and then they end up on a plate somewhere a couple of years later. And there was keen interest in reducing our operations in terms of how many cows we had on the property and expanding how many cows we could finish on the property. I mean, there's no doubt that the grass-fed market, grass-fed beef market, and even kind of the more specific term of grass-finished beef or pasture-finished beef market is really a growing one, and there's a lot of attractiveness to it. It's a matter of finding consistency in the meat itself, because you know, not all grass is the same. So there's a much deeper focus on the ranch producer level, and then also consistency in buying. So if we're able to say to regional ranching communities around the country, there is a number of interested parties in, so we're looking a lot at the cooperative models of producing and purchasing, because it's time and time again really shown success in other markets. I mean, just a much different crop of coffee, for example, has seen some tremendous gains in working in a cooperative model. I would say there may even be more interest in beginning to take on improvements in the kind of the small small mid-size feedlots, and that's a kind of small mid-size. I mean, there's not numbers of head of cattle there, but where you're really thinking about these owner operators already have pretty deep-seated value for how they're producing beef, and if there's a way in which we can go on property and say, looking at key specific places for improvement, for example, where are you buying your feed from? How is your feed produced? What's the average time to maturity once your cows, go into a feedlot, and looking to reduce that time? But no doubt there's interest from producers throughout the supply chain of beef, and I would say, chicken is different, and you definitely made that point clear. And I think one of the key reasons is just the age to maturity of these animals, and in the lifetime of a cow, and we're talking about hundreds of mature chickens can
right.
kind of go to market in the life of one cow. So that, and also I think we both have said it without saying it, but I think the reason that beef is such an important focus is because it has such a massive impact on our environment, and its supply chain is not vertically integrated, and it's very fragmented, and it's really there's a challenge in locating where the chain of custody is, or where the deep kind of wins or areas, again, leverage points for improvement. There's many different strategic pathways to shifting this industry, and I think absolutely working on the producer level, and if you can, so we were able to exactly that in Montana, shift much of our production over to a pasture finished one, and also be able to build key buying relationships with local restaurants in Missoula and kind of that surrounding kind of urban hub that really had a growing understanding of wanting to know where your food and specifically your meat comes from and how it was raised. So I think that was a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, lots to cover. I mean, I kind of set you up there. Well, Gabrielle, unfortunately, we are out of time for today. I'm looking forward to connecting with you more in Denver, and I will advise folks, check out the NRDC and their work, and they can also find you on Twitter. You are at Gabrielle_Krenza, which is KRENZA. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
So we are going to take a short station break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Leah Garces, the U.S. Director for Compassion and World Farming, to hear a little bit more about this Walmart announcement that we alluded to at the top of the show. So hang tight. You're listening to the Farm Report, and we'll be right back.
escape. EscapeMaker.com, a guide to local getaways, is offering a two-night farm escape that includes lodging, a visit to an apiary, wine tasting at a vineyard, and a special tour of Bobolink Dairy and Bakehouse in Milford, New Jersey. Transportation is included. For details, visit EscapeMaker.com or come by the Bobolink Dairy stand at the new open-air Fulton Stall Market on Front Street in the South Street Seaport District. Located where New York City's public food markets began in the 1800s, Fulton Stall Market is open weekends 10 to 5 and is the first farmers market in the city to offer ready-to-eat foods made by the farmers who produce them, along with a radio station, live music, and cooking workshops for families. Now offering spring flowers and plants, organic vegetables, pizza made in a wood-burning oven using farm ingredients, local fruit preserves, yogurts, and ice cream, and Bobolink Dairy's famous artisanal cheese and breads. The market is a great reason to rediscover the authentic Seaport. For more information, visit FultonStallMarket.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we are back. We are on the line with Leah Garces. She is the U.S. Director for Compassion in World Farming. Back with us to give us a little bit more info on this new Walmart position announcement. Leah, thanks for taking some time to join us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to be back on the show.
So Walmart, definitely not the organization that we here at the station are used to holding up as an example for some progressive steps forward in the animal welfare or antibiotics or sustainable food space. Are we just totally getting things wrong here? Give us the update.
So on Friday, as you know, Walmart made a big announcement. They're the largest retailer in the country, and they announced their first comprehensive animal welfare program. And that's a big deal. It's really a kind of putting a flagpole down and saying, this is the direction of travel for Walmart. Walmart is making animal welfare matter to its business. And so that's the first time they've done that, and it's a big deal. I really think it's a game changer for the market in the United States for animal welfare.
So how did they decide, do you think, or do you have any insight on what to say in this position? I mean, who is helping Walmart with their kind of strategy and with their thinking around these topics?
There's a number of stakeholders involved, and we have been involved since 2012 with something called the Business Benchmark for Farm Animal Welfare, in which Walmart was benchmarked. And in that particular benchmark, they didn't score very well. But with this new position paper, they will, because they're doing more disclosure, more transparency about farm animal welfare. I think they're very determined to improve their image. You know, they had 6 undercover investigations put out by Mercy for Animal in the last year or so. They've had other negative kind of images associated with their brand and farm animal welfare, and I think they're looking to turn that around. Animal welfare matters to their customers, and they know that. And I think this policy tries to address some of the most egregious issues like close confinement and pain management. And it's putting, like I said, putting a flagpole down and saying, we're moving away from those practices. And I think that's especially important for their suppliers to hear. The largest retailer in the country is moving away from gestation crates and battery cages, and there's no point in reinvesting in those sorts of industries. There's no point in reinvesting in a new gestation crate because the direction of travel for the industry is away from that.
Well, it's definitely super exciting. And also, I mean, really the largest retailer in the country. What do you think, I mean, what kind of gauntlet has this thrown down for other grocery chains and food suppliers?
It's definitely raising the bar. I mean, they're raising the baseline standard and they're saying, you know, this is the new normal. The new normal is no antibiotics, you know, and moving away from these closed confinement systems like gestation crates from other pigs, barren battery cages for laying hens, and fill crates for cows. That's the new normal. If you just want to survive in the industry, you need to get rid of those practices. And then, you know, the leaders are going to want to do even better than that, the ones who want to get ahead in the market.
So how do we respond to folks who I know are going to reach out to me and say, you know, this is bullshit, it's a position paper, it's not a policy paper, it's a PR move, and you're supporting it by having, you know, by giving it space on your show?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that, and I hope customers will continue to hound Walmart and say, now carry through with this statement, you know, carry through. And the years ahead will be the years that determine whether Walmart does or doesn't. And it's going to be very important for consumers and watchdogs to keep the pressure on and say, you know, you put the flagpole down, now follow through with that commitment.
Do you think, are there other retailers who on a smaller scale have followed this same kind of trajectory where they announce a kind of thought change, position change, and then follow it up? I mean, is there a landscape for this type of shift, maybe on a smaller scale, or other places we can look to say, like, oh yeah, these guys did it first, and this is how it's going, and this is the time frame we can be expecting?
Absolutely. I think in the last 6 months, we've seen some of the three biggest food service companies in the world, Aramark, Compass, and Sodexo, make announcements about moving away from battery cages and for both their liquid and their shelled eggs. And each time a company makes an announcement like this, they're making an improvement. So, you know, companies like that will first make have made announcements around shelled eggs, and then they'll say, okay, now we're moving on liquid eggs. And some companies have started with just this kind of comprehensive policy, and then they go for more species-specific policy. So we're definitely seeing a trend in the market where, you know, just to be considered normal in the market now, you need to say animal welfare matters to your business. You need to have a corporate policy on this, and you need to say to consumers what you're doing about it.
So should we be concerned about, I mean, this is kind of a weird question for me to be asking, I guess, but I'm wondering if we should be concerned about farmers, about producers who, you know, they have this large scale investment in these kind of crates, in these production systems, and we're essentially, you know, asking them to turn their whole operation around and to kind of rethink everything they're doing, and all that infrastructure, you know, it has kind of in a way that the flip has been switched towards phasing that out. You know, is there things we need to be thinking about when we think about from a sheer capacity, ability, transition space as consumers? You know, it's not like you can flip the switch and there's suddenly a whole supply chain that is now meeting our new criteria. Like, how do we think about that landscape from the farmer's perspective?
Well, I think companies have thought about that, and that's why you see in Walmart there's no commitment date, which is one of the drawbacks of their statement. So they haven't set a date for implementation, and I think that's because they don't know how long it's going to take for some of their farmers to transition out of these systems. I think they will make, I hope they will make a date announcement in future when they have some more information. But typically, a gestation crate, when it's newly built, has a lifespan of about 9 years, 8 years. So that's why you saw McDonald's, when they made an announcement a few years back, they said, maybe about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, they said they were moving away from gestation crates and they would no longer be taking pork from gestation crates by 2022. So they gave a fair amount of time to say, even if you invested today, the lifespan of that gestation crate comes to an end at 9 years. That's when you should be replacing them anyway. So it's saying, we'll let you live out your investments, and then at the end of that, you need to transition. And I think that's a fair way for farmers to be given enough time to think about how to transition and not to lose their investment.
And because, you know, your organization, I know you are the U.S. director, but it is an international organization. When statements come out like this in the U.S., can you give us a little sense, if you know, kind of how they're heard in other parts of the world? I mean, are people like, wow, they're really like doing something amazing? Or they're like, oh my God, I can't believe that's a problem there.
No, you know, it's funny. I mean, we have like we are an international organization, and we had like Facebook congratulations, you know, from Norway. Like, I was reading one today from Norway saying, you know, this is wonderful. I mean, no one doesn't know that Walmart is a giant and that it has, you know, this enormous capacity to either improve or make the lives of animals worse. So I think everyone understands that this is a big deal, no matter where they're from. You know, in the EU, gestation crates are banned. And battery cages are banned already, and veal crates are banned. So, you know, what we're talking about doing in the U.S. is the legislative minimum in the EU. But that doesn't mean that it's not hard and that companies don't need help and don't need sort of support in getting to that minimum. And that's what we're here to do.
So real quick before we let you go, what can folks look forward to from Compassion and World Farming over the summer? Anything that we should be keeping our eyes on?
Yeah, we're having something called Pasture Poultry Week coming up July 13th to the 19th, where we highlight best practice. And we're going to be looking at celebrating farms and restaurants that are swapping out using conventional chicken and using pasture-raised chicken from farms, you know, local farms such as White Oak Pastures and others. So check out our website at CIWF.com to find out which restaurants to go to and which farmers we're working with. It's going to be really fun.
Awesome. Leah, thank you so much for jumping on the call and helping us understand this announcement.
My pleasure, as always.
So we're going to take another quick break. If you want to hear more from Leah, definitely check her out on Twitter at Leah_compassion. And when we come back, it's time for the Escape Maker segment. Stay tuned. It's a fun one this week. We're going to be talking with Steve Penning of Penning's Farm, and that is coming up after the break. We are back for one of my new favorite parts of the show, the Escape Maker segment, where we learn a little bit more about some awesome places to check out here in the New York and greater New York metro area. Today, we're taking a little trip up to Hudson Valley. We are on the line with Steve Penning of Penning's Farm. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Yes, how are you this afternoon, Aaron?
I am great. So I was so tickled to learn that your family got their start in the egg business as a tulip farm in Holland, before moving, you know, relocating the business and the farm and the family, obviously, to New York State. So can you tell us maybe a little bit about how your family got involved
Our
in agriculture?
Started, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, it's all primarily about my parents. My dad was an immigrant from Holland back in 1940 or so. Came here selling tulip bulbs for the family business in Holland, which still exists there. There's second and third generation Pennings is over there, still farming and growing bulbs, tulip daffodils, you know, the hyacinths, all the Easter stuff and spring bulb business is very strong yet in Holland and exported all across the world. So that's what he came here doing, and you know, fell in love with America like so many people that immigrated here did, and continue to, and settled in the Orange County area in Goshen, and shortly thereafter met my mother, and decided to just make America his home in Orange County, and then they worked their way down to Warwick, where we still are today, and we're on one of the farms that he purchased back in the 1960s that we still own. We were dairy farmers for many years, and in the last 25 years, 30 years, we got into the orchard business, and through the orchard business, we've evolved into many, many more things and developed developed a very diversified agricultural, entertainment type operation.
Yeah, I would say the many options. So you guys do the orchard stuff, but you also have a pub. There's like a beer garden, ice cream. I mean, it sounds like you can kind of do anything you want. When we head over your way.
It scares me. It scares me, but it's true. And it's kind of been, we've built it to be a place for all ages. You know, we built our business on the garden, on the farm market garden center, with an ice cream stand, and a little petting zoo. So it was very family oriented towards little kids, you know, young families with little kids, things like that, with a lot of fall activities, because still our primary business is pick your own apples in the fall, with pick your own pumpkins and hay rides and all that kind of stuff. But we've evolved into a very year-round business that we can entertain you pretty much any time of year. We're just opened in the last month. Our beer garden reopened, so that's open, and it's a we do live music in the beer garden, and you know, that's more of an adult venue. But it's located right near the petting zoo, so families with little kids get to enjoy both, and. So we're very diversified, and we've got a cafe as well, and we're selling a lot of craft beer as well as our own hard cider that's being made for us at the moment. That's going to be brought in-house. That's our next venture, is to put up a cidery here on the farm. So we have a lot of moving parts, and yeah, it scares me how many are moving, and you know, you got to make sure they're all moving in the right direction, and we have great employees here on the farm, and full-time employees, full-time staff that works year-round for us now.
Oh, man. Well, definitely a lovely landscape. Steve, we only have a couple moments left here, but I was hoping I might be able to take you through a couple of rapid-fire questions. Just take your temperature in a couple different spaces in the farm. So,
sure.
Favorite ice cream flavor?
Favorite ice cream flavor remains to be vanilla.
Oh, classic. So, favorite spot to hang on the farm or get a quiet moment or a rowdy moment? What's your, like, go-to kind of recharge space?
We have a spot up on top of the farm called The Tree, and it's where we watch the sunset from, and it's when we need to get away from the rest of the traffic that's around here. We shoot up there, whether it's just me and my wife, Jill, or us and our kids, or us and a bunch of our employees sometimes, get on the back of the pickup truck, and that's where we hide.
Awesome. What about, you feel like, the most kind of underrated activity, the fun thing that you can't believe more people don't do when they come visit you guys?
Oh, man, the most fun activity that people can do that don't do. Well, you know, like I said, apple picking is a primary function in the fall, that and pumpkins, and the hay rides, and people tend to come here to do that. So, you know, I mean, it's not like such a big place that we have hidden opportunities. I think when you come, you see what we got, and most people take advantage of most of it, and they'll sit in the beer garden, listen to music for a while. They'll browse through the garden center. They'll, you know, get something to eat for sure at our cafe, because we have a lot of great food coming out of that. And sip on our great craft beers that we bring in from all across the country. You know, we still bring in a lot of regional New York State beers, but we also bring in beers from Colorado, California, Oregon, all over the place. So.
Wow. So I think for me, probably the biggest challenge would be figuring out the order in which I wanted to do that stuff.
Right, right. Well, you know, most logically, you should come in and browse through the garden center and do your shopping and then get settled into something to eat and then savor some of the craft beers that we serve and local wines as well as California wines.
Oh, man. I probably would go for ice cream first, but that's just me. Well,
that's right. Ice cream for breakfast is a fine thing. There's nothing wrong with
that.
Do
it like the Italians. Put on a little brioche. Well, I want to give a big thank you to Escape Maker for both sponsoring the show and for turning us on to your great spot. And final question, what about for you and your family when you're looking to escape? Do you have a go-to off-farm spot?
Oh, when we need to escape, we usually go to the beach.
Nice. I'm going to do that this weekend. Awesome. All right.
We go the other way, you know. We see enough of the farm.
Exactly.
And we live on the farm, and we're thinking about the farm all the time. We do some, work study up when we do some traveling, and we'll go upstate New York into the Finger Lakes. It's beautiful up there. My son just graduated from Cornell, and there's just awesome operations up there, wineries, breweries, farm markets, pick-your-own operations. Speaking of which, this weekend we have a very big function on the farm. We have our fourth annual beer festival on the farm, and it's a great event. We have 35 breweries and 5 cideries going to be here. So it's a one-price ticket admission. It goes from 2 to 6. I recommend people take a drive up. It'll be a great event. Music all afternoon. It includes food. So look online at penningsfarmmarket.com, and you'll find out all you need to know.
Awesome. Steve, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great chatting with you.
Yes. I thank you very much, Aaron, and let's hope for a great growing season, and we're open 7 days a week.
Awesome. So definitely check out Penning's Farm and a ton of other great getaways, whether you got a day, a couple of hours, the weekend, or something more luxurious, escapemaker.com. Want to give them a shout out and say thanks for continuing to support the Farm Report and other great programs on the Heritage Radio Network. This show, like all 39 of our live weekly shows, is available for free. Obviously, visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.com or .org, both work. We hope that you'll support our work by becoming a member. Click that donate tab and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.